I next met with Dr. Ed Kim for an update of the exciting work being done at MD Anderson Cancer Center. And to begin, I asked him about adjuvant therapy, a topic that seems to have cooled off a bit in interest and visibility since the initial barrage of new data in the field about 5 years ago.
As far as adjuvant therapy, it's interesting that you bring that up. It just hasn't really been in the news. I think in the next couple years, we are going to hear about the RADIANT data with adjuvant erlotinib. Well, we may hear actually a report of the trial that started but didn't finish with adjuvant gefitinib as well. That's going to be out of Canada. We haven't seen any markers that have really been incorporated to help us make decisions as far as which patients should receive adjuvant therapy or not. Again, we're still basing it on a size criteria, and it's kind of a loose size criteria. Most people like to use the 4-centimeter rule. But again, someone who's 3 centimeters and high risk or really wants therapy, I don't hesitate to give them adjuvant-based cisplatin-based therapy.
Can you talk a little bit about what we know about ERCC1?
Yeah, ERCC1 has been looked at to see if one will benefit or whether cisplatin-based therapy would work in that particular patient. The problem with ERCC1 and the reason why I don't think you're seeing many people use it is that it's measured several different ways, assessed as far as doing it. The Moffitt group and Bepler are doing it one way, and Jean-Charles Soria in France, who reported it in the New England Journal of Medicine, used it a different way. And even the scales of degree of percentage of ERCC1 can be a little bit different. So to say what is positive and what's negative is a little bit more tricky. It's a little bit more like EGFR and IHC. Is it a 1+, 2+, 3+? And does that really then sway you in one direction or another? These folks who have upregulation of ERCC1, essentially they're almost resistant to cisplatin, per se.
Isn't there a trial going on right now that's actually prospectively trying to look at this?
Yeah, that's the MADIT study that the Moffitt is doing and are leading a multi-center study. That is in metastatic, though. It's not in adjuvant. But it is trying to stratify and look at ERCC1 as one of its markers to see which patients may have it and if, in fact, they may benefit more from non-platinum-based therapies. They're incorporating gemcitabine and docetaxel and other different agents other than platinum. Again, the trial is still accruing. They're accruing at a nice rate, but it's still going to be, I think, a couple years from the last accrual numbers I've seen George Simon present.
And can you talk a little bit about what your current approach is outside a protocol setting to the use of adjuvant therapy in terms of who gets treated and what agents are used?
So right now in the adjuvant setting, I'll look at the patient, I'll look at the pathology. Clearly, the pathologic staging is very important and will make sure that there's no other distant metastatic disease. If I have a patient who has a staging of a stage 2 or a stage 3A, I will give them 4 cycles of cisplatin-based chemotherapy. The options clearly are vinorelbine, gemcitabine, docetaxel, and pemetrexed, especially if it's a non-squamous. In a squamous cell, basically gemcitabine, vinorelbine, docetaxel with cisplatin are my choices. If the patient is a larger 1B, and again, what is larger? Pretty arbitrary. Again, I sort of use my own 3 centimeters to 4 centimeters and larger. I will explain to them the risks and the benefits of the adjuvant-based therapy. Again, we know the stage 1s, especially the smaller stage 1s, their risk-benefit ratio is not as good as someone who has a 3A with lymph nodes and higher risk and worse overall survival at 5 years. But I do favor giving those larger tumors in stage 1 adjuvant-based chemotherapy. If they have a smaller stage 1A, then I will explain to them again the risks and the benefits. And in fact, there may be no benefit for them to receive the therapy, or it may only be about 1% better, and let them decide. Some patients are clearly very aggressive and they want to have anything that they can sustain to help them with their disease. And those people, if they have a 2-centimeter tumor, I have no issue of giving them chemotherapy as long as they understand the risks and the benefits. Some people are, gosh, I've went through the surgery. I don't want anything more to do with doctors. Just let me go in peace. And so those are folks that I will not push the chemotherapy. However, if it's a large stage 1B, 2 or 3, and a patient does not want chemotherapy, I will tell them that is going against my recommendation.
What about the selection of agent to pair with cis? How do you go about making that decision?
Well, Neil, I think you just flip a coin probably with one of them. You need about a four-sided coin. The agents right now, I think we're trying to get less toxic. And you will run into some folks who are very traditional and want to use minorelbine because that was the regimen that was used most commonly in most of the large major studies. I have on record with you and others have said that I would have no problem using cis docetaxel in lieu of the TAX-326 data. And also I would have no issue using cis pemetrexed, especially in a non-squamous as well. I think any cisplatin-based therapy is probably equivalent.
You mentioned the TAX-326 study.
That was the metastatic study.
Can you explain what that looked at and why it affects the way you look at this question?
Well, TAX-326 was the registration trial for docetaxel in advanced stage, and it was cis docetaxel versus cis vinorelbine. And then there was also a carboplatin docetaxel arm as well. So it was three arms, 400 patients roughly per arm, non-inferiority endpoint, and actually showed that cis docetaxel was definitely not inferior to cis vinorelbine, and in fact, median survival was a little bit better. So translating that data from the metastatic setting to the adjuvant setting is where I've made the extrapolation. Some people don't like to make extrapolations, and they say you should just use cisvinorelbine. The irony about that is many people who are adamant about using cisvinorelbine in the adjuvant setting based on the studies do not even use the doses or the schedules that were used in those studies. So again, everybody is doing some extrapolation, whether they're not giving the weekly vinorelbine for 4 weeks, they're going 2 out of 3. I think it's okay to switch out drugs, especially if they have demonstrated efficacy in the metastatic setting.
What are some of the trials out there right now in the adjuvant setting that you think, you know, might have some effect on practice? You mentioned the RADIANT study. Can you go through what that looks at and also the adjuvant bevacizumab study?
Yeah, so the two anticipated studies in the adjuvant setting, one includes RADIANT, which is randomized folks who have completed surgical resection. You may or may not have received 4 cycles of chemotherapy, and then you're randomized to either erlotinib or placebo for 2 years. That study will finish first, and I think we'll see some interesting information, especially in smokers versus those who don't smoke, and et cetera. The ECOG 1505 study, this is the intergroup study, which is looking at 4 cycles of chemotherapy in combination with bevacizumab as adjuvant therapy in one arm, and then 4 cycles of chemotherapy alone in the other arm, again in stage 1 through 3A resected patients. These are then randomized to either chemotherapy versus chemotherapy plus bevacizumab, and then the bevacizumab is given for 1 year as a maintenance afterwards. There were some questions that were raised in lieu of the colon cancer data in the adjuvant setting that was given for a set amount of period of time, and perhaps there should be longer maintenance being done. And of course, maintenance is now becoming more of our mainstream conversation and language. However, I think 1 year is adequate, and hopefully it will be enough to improve the chemotherapy to show overall improvement. The problem with this study, though, is it's been terribly slow to accrue, and largely because, not of interest, but because the surgeries that are being performed on lung cancer patients are not being done completely. So the eligibility actually has been the problem with the patient because they don't have full lymph node dissections or comprehensive samplings done.
What about the issue of preoperative therapy? What is some of the research that's been done looking at that question? And are there any situations where you might consider it outside a protocol setting?
Well, we're a little biased at MD Anderson because our surgeons clearly for years have believed in neoadjuvant or induction chemotherapy. We do it in select patients off protocol. Again, it is after a multidisciplinary discussion has been gone through, and these patients are resectable up front. I think people get confused when they talk about neoadjuvant in that they think they can downstage a patient from an unresectable to a resectable patient. If a patient is clearly unresectable up front, you need to just proceed with concurrent combined modality therapy with radiation and chemotherapy. However, there are some patients with borderline disease, stage 3As especially, that have N2 disease present. you might be able to actually get a favorable response by giving them chemotherapy and getting them through an operation. And we have done this on a study as well as off study. The study that we recently completed enrolled 54 patients. This was presented at ASCO in a poster session this year, looking at neoadjuvant cisplatin and docetaxel, giving that for 3 cycles after surgery and then 1 year of erlotinib afterwards. Pilot study, phase 2, but we are more importantly looking at the biomarkers that we are going to obtain pre-chemotherapy and then after the chemotherapy with the surgery. That's our second set of markers. We're going to try and see if we can see some resistance or sensitivity patterns, especially to the chemotherapy.
What markers are you looking at?
Well, right now it's a very broad net. Certainly the basic ones we've talked about ERCC1, RM1, matter. But we've developed some gene signatures that are actually specific to docetaxel that may predict a response or resistance. And so those are arrays that are being done as well.
I guess in breast cancer, Jenny Chang has tried to look at the question of markers or response to docetaxel. What specifically would you expect maybe would be correlated with response?
Well, again, that's a very difficult question to answer right now. I think the traditional markers that we've thought about with transport mechanisms, et cetera, don't really apply. We really looked more at reverse phase protein arrays and other things that show us signatures and patterns that may actually make a difference, and this clustering of markers that may help us predict one way or another.
Is there any patient in your practice, either on or off study, where you've utilized neoadjuvant therapy that you think it might be useful or for us to kind of go through the case so we get a better idea of how it can be helpful?
Well, yeah, there's a gentleman who I saw recently, the 39-year-old gentleman who came from Florida, who showed up and had stage 3A disease. He was a never smoker, and he came to see us and wanted our opinions. He didn't have a lot of disease, but he certainly had enough that made it tricky for us to resect.
Where exactly did he have the disease, and what kind of staging was done?
Right, so his PET scan showed a right upper lobe nodule. SUV was 5.4. However, he also had mediastinal disease on the right side and pre- and subcarinal lymph nodes. Nothing contralateral, but with the mediastinal and the subcarinal, that's multistation right there.
And he had tissue?
Yes, he had a mediastinoscopy, and that was positive for the subcarinal as well as a high right paratracheal lymph node.
It was what, adenocarcinoma?
Correct, with BAC features. He was not Asian, but he was an ever smoker. So we discussed with him, and that's all the information I had at the time when I saw him. And we had our surgeons evaluate him as well. And we thought because he was very healthy, he was young, and had good lung function, that it was worth it to try neoadjuvant chemotherapy in him. Now, in these folks, if we don't see profound shrinkage or if surgery does not seem to be able to be performed, we can always do concurrent chemoradiation on a gentleman like this. So we felt it was a low-risk situation. We thought he would tolerate chemotherapy very well.
Now, what were you trying to achieve with the preoperative therapy?
Well, we'd like to try ideally to clear some of the N2 lymph nodes because that would certainly help his overall outcome. We know that outcome in a pathologic staging situation is really, really tied into the lymph nodes.
So what happened?
Yeah, it doesn't always happen the way you want to, but in his situation, it was quite unique. Because he was an adenocarcinoma, I gave him 2 cycles of a cisplatin and pemetrexed. Now, during the time of which we were giving the second cycle of pemetrexed, I got his EGFR mutational status back, and it was actually positive for an exon 19 deletion. So he returned after 2 cycles of chemotherapy and had a very decent response on his scan. We would call it a partial response, but very good. And we had a long talk at that point because he did have this deletion of exon 19, and we were going to see if he responded very well. And if he responded very well, I said to myself, we'll continue with the current therapy. Some people may elect to go to a EGFR inhibitor such as erlotinib at this point. It's easier to make that decision in the metastatic setting. It's harder to make that decision in the curative neoadjuvant setting. So I compromised in my mind. I said, let's give the 3rd cycle. I'll bring him back. We'll repeat the scan. And if he didn't get as great a response as I wanted him to, then I was going to give him erlotinib up till his operative date, which would have been 10 to 14 days later. And what happened was, actually, he cleared all of his disease via PET scan when I saw him after 3 cycles. So he had a great response, and actually in surgery, all the lymph nodes had cleared as well, pathologically. So he only had about a 1.5 centimeter tumor left in his right lung.
What happened after surgery?
So right now we are going to give him postoperative radiotherapy because he did have a documented pathological presence of N2 disease. But certainly his prognosis has changed quite a bit because he had clearance of this disease due to therapy. So we're going to give him postoperative radiotherapy. He's getting that right now. And then it'll be my decision if, as we have a conversation after he's finished, of whether we want to give any erlotinib or not. My sense is I would lean not toward giving him any erlotinib at this point because he's had such a great response to therapy. And there can be side effects, of course, with long-term usage. But that's a conversation he and I will have.
What do we know about what's seen pathologically when you get an imaging complete response, but you actually go in there and take it out? This comes up a lot. We just did a big project on surgical treatment of metastases to the liver and colorectal cancer. And there, so often, almost always, even though the CAT scan of the liver looks normal after having systemic therapy, when they go in, they see cancer cells. What about in lung cancer?
I'm pretty happy that we actually are starting to talk a little bit more about PathCR in lung cancer. As you know, in breast cancer, it's used quite often. I think we are getting a little bit better as far as looking at things from a pathologic CR rate. We know that the PathCR is always more prognostic than the clinical CR. So although you might see great things on scans, you might shrink 90%, and just as you say, it may shrink 100%, if you've still got cells there, it's still there. And it doesn't seem to improve your outcome that much, especially if you have presence of cells still there. However, if you do clear places and you do achieve a pathologic CR, which we know we can in some people in lung cancer, it's just we haven't found out who is going to be able to do that, then I think you will improve outcome, and I think we'll see more of that. Yeah, right now, if you went with the prevailing literature, neoadjuvant therapy is not the recommended therapy. You would proceed with someone who was surgical to go ahead and perform the surgery and then decide to give them adjuvant chemotherapy on the back end. However, studies have been done through the SWOG and other research groups that have tried to utilize platinum-based therapy and, in fact, have used carboplatin for the most part in many of these folks. And again, did not show statistical significance. I think it's a similar situation in what we had with the adjuvant data, in that we had many trials that were hard to accrue to, that took many years, and did not show anything compelling. And that's why people did not give adjuvant therapy in the first place. I think we're a little further behind even with neoadjuvant. However, if we develop and sort of skip a step rather than running the large phase threes and really try to find markers that can predict sensitivity to certain drugs, then I think we can bypass a lot of the larger studies that are required and really focus on subpopulations with specific drugs to really show an effect.
What about management of locally advanced disease? You mentioned chemoradiation therapy. Anything new that's come out over the past year from a research perspective in managing these patients?
Well, not a lot as far as management. I think the things we are focusing on is that there are other forms of radiation that are being done. I think there are doses of radiation that are being pushed as far as the envelope. Used to be that you could only give 60, 61 gray. Now you hear routinely 67 up to 70 gray in certain areas with boosts. Proton radiation is something that's being utilized, although we don't have any data at this time to suggest it's any better or any safer, although those studies are being done, especially compared to IMRT. I think some of the agents that we're looking at, again, hopefully we'll make some advances here. Largely it's been a platinum taxane weekly schedule with different agents, or it's been the SWOG 9504 cisplatinotopicide regimens. I think cetuximab has a good chance of being an agent that we use in the future. I think pemetrexed, which is also very tolerable at its standard dose, has a good chance of being something that's being tested. We're actually testing erlotinib with radiation and chemotherapy, believe it or not, in non-small cell lung cancer, and then seen some intriguing results in a phase 2 study. So I think it's still a very open area to test agents that may have radiosensitizing and chemosensitizing properties.
What's the design of the erlotinib study, and what have you seen so far?
Well, it's a single-center pilot study. Again, we have tissue available to test for markers up front if we need it, although that's not used for stratification. And patients are given weekly carboplatin paclitaxel with erlotinib daily. And just some of our comments from the radiotherapists have stated that they're impressed with the responses that they're seeing. Again, we don't have long-term data with follow-up, but very intriguing.
Now, these are all comers, regardless of mutation status?
Correct.
And what about post-treatment? Do you continue their erlotinib?
There is an option to continue the erlotinib in some folks, and I'd say some of them do and some of them don't.
What about post-combined chemo radiation therapy treatment? You know, there was a debate about whether docetaxel was going to add anything, and then the Hogg trial came out, and that seemed to put a kibosh on that. And yet, I still look at this and wonder whether or not the current chemo radiation therapy is providing sort of enough kind of systemic hit. What are your thoughts on that?
I would agree with you. I think we have this debate quite often in head and neck. It's the same thing, right? Whether single agent high dose cis is enough really to treat folks. And we don't have as much data on the adjuvant end as we do in lung, as we do in head and neck. But my thought has always been, I was a little disappointed in the Hogg trial, as you pointed out. I'd really wished that there was a benefit there. I think we all were, but there wasn't. I would still leave the option open to giving patients a couple cycles of full-dose chemotherapy afterwards. By no means is that based on any clinical trial that's been done, but it is with the principle that you want to give more systemic coverage for these patients. And we know, especially these patients who are getting combined modality therapy, they have the highest risk of distant metastatic disease due to their nodal status. Now, should everybody get two cycles? No. I think we took it a little too far beforehand where people were getting four or six cycles after chemo radiation. I think that's too much. And I think not everybody is equipped to handle the side effects of chemotherapy after 6 weeks of intensive chemo radiation. So I think we have to be very selective about who we believe can tolerate it.
Now, you mentioned the issue of cetuximab in terms of combining it with radiation therapy, and of course, there have been the very positive results in head and neck cancer. What do we know about that strategy in lung cancer?
Well, George Blumenschein had reported the phase 2 experience with carboplatin, paclitaxel, and cetuximab with radiation, and there is a phase 3 that the RTOG is doing as we speak to try and answer this question. So we've seen that it's pretty safe and tolerable, and in fact may improve efficacy as well. The numbers in the phase 2 study were quite impressive, so that's what led them to the phase 3.
Any situations where you might consider that strategy outside a protocol setting?
Cetuximab's hard to get right now, Neil. The insurance company has ruled the world, and so it's a little bit tough. I would be all in favor of using it. I think it's safe. I think you're not going to harm the patient, but again, off study, it's hard to do that.
Why don't we talk a little bit about management of advanced disease? And you had a 52-year-old woman that you were going to present, maybe to give us an idea how you approach it.
And this is a woman from Texas who showed up to her primary medical doctor with dry cough, shortness of breath, and low-grade fever. Now, mind you, she has no history of asthma, but was treated for asthma. And then given antibiotics, and then given steroids and the usual stuff. And about 3 to 4 months later, finally a chest x-ray was done and showed something abnormal, which led to a CAT scan, which eventually showed a 3.5-centimeter lesion in the left lower lobe, mediastinal lymphadenopathy, and unfortunately, liver metastasis. At the same time, there was a fullness around the pericardium, and this quickly actually led to tamponade in her.
So she had clinical tamponade?
Clinical tamponade, yeah, shortly afterwards. So they drained it, and the cytology was actually negative. Now, again, cytology is not 100%, and you have to have clinical suspicion here as well. They then did a bronchoscopy, and it was adenocarcinoma.
Smoker or non-smoker?
She was a light smoker, as we would call her. Almost a never smoker, but had some, maybe a little bit in college, etc. So the decision was, what do we do in her? She did not have any brain lesions, but she certainly had distant metastatic disease. So she was given carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab. And she was able to tolerate that pretty well and then went on to bevacizumab maintenance thereafter. The bev maintenance in her actually went almost, about 10 or 11 months. And she was doing very well. And then all of a sudden, she developed a DVT at the same time with a pericardial effusion and required a window at this time for drainage. And in fact, the cytology was positive now for adenocarcinoma, sort of what we suspected before. Because we had seen some progression on her CT, slow progression during the maintenance setting, we had talked about giving her carbo-PEM with the Bev because it had been more than 6 months since she'd received any chemotherapy. Her performance status was great. And after the DVT and the pericardial effusion, obviously that went out the window and we stopped the bevacizumab. So we recently have started her on carboplatin and pemetrexed. Now, you ask yourself, why are we giving her a doublet at this point, and why not go with a single agent second-line therapy? The reason is she's young. She's been almost 2 years since she's had any chemotherapy, and it's almost like restarting her initial therapy in my mind. So we gave her carbapem. It was interesting. She had a carboplatin reaction. And this can hurt, obviously. This can occur in subsequent cycles of carboplatin. Never happens up front. So despite using any type of prophylaxis and desensitization, we couldn't get it in her. So now she's on just single-agent pemetrexed. But she was tolerating it well and did have a response, a slight response after two cycles.
What kind of reaction did she have?
These are hypersensitivity reactions. They're allergic reactions. And with carboplatin, you can see this in latter cycles especially. Usually it takes an exposure and then you have another exposure later. So it's not atypical to see these during cycle two or three. What was very odd about her was she didn't have any during her initial chemotherapy. And then we retreated her 2 years later and then she had one.
What about mutation testing in her?
She did not have the presence of any mutation in her tumor.
Can you talk a little bit about where you see mutation fitting in today and specifically maybe go through the IPASS study and how that's affected your decision about whether to test patients and the algorithm?
In this particular case with mutation testing, I can tell you, Neil, that if she had been able to stay on bevacizumab maintenance, the debate I had with retreating her with systemic chemotherapy versus adding erlotinib was very close in my mind. I really feel like patients like this can still benefit with erlotinib or EGFR TKIs despite not having the mutation. Now, that being said, let's say from the beginning she had an EGFR mutation. Now the choice of therapy in this healthy woman is an EGFR TKI like erlotinib, or it's a combination chemotherapy with bevacizumab. As you know, IPASS did not assess bevacizumab-based therapy. It was gefitinib versus carboplatin and paclitaxel. So that's one thing that we don't get in the equation and have to sort of decide. The second thing is that does it really matter what you start with? Does it more matter that you get the therapy in? I.e., if you start with chemotherapy and you can be pretty assured that you're going to get erlotinib in the second line, does it really impact survival that much whether you go erlotinib first, then chemotherapy, or chemotherapy first, then erlotinib? So although we do like having a lot of information up front, and I would love to have EGFR mutation testing done and the results with me when I'm discussing treatment options with the patient, it may influence me to move forward with erlotinib-based therapy up front, or gefitinib if we get it down the road here, as opposed to starting with chemotherapy. And that has nothing to do with efficacy, but everything to do with quality of life standpoints. If I don't have the information, then I discuss it with the patient, but I'm probably more apt to lean toward chemotherapy first, especially these patients who have disease that's outside the chest. And in her case, she had previous pericardial effusion, liver metastases, etc.
You started this patient on carboplatin and bevacizumab. First, how do you decide which patients you're going to use bevacizumab in? Obviously, they're not going to have squamous cell, but beyond that, what are some of the parameters that you use to decide?
You know, I'll tell you right now, there are fewer restrictions for using bevacizumab in patients other than making sure they don't have a majority squamous component. If they have treated brain metastases, I have no issue with using bevacizumab. If they have any DVTs that are previously from prior to a treatment with bevacizumab and are being treated, I have no issue with that as well. Really, it is the hemoptysis issue and the histology issue that will sway me away from bevacizumab, and also recent cardiac issues.
What about the actual diagnosis in terms of histology? And this, of course, comes in terms of decisions about pemetrexed, but there was a presentation at ASCO that kind of, I found it a little hard to follow, but from what I could understand, it looked like there was a lot of difficulty deciding whether something was squamous or non-squamous. What do we know about pathologically how accurate that is?
Yeah, I have to be careful and not say too much here because I agree. It's very, very difficult. Being immersed in the environment that I'm in an academic tertiary center, we do a lot of very detailed work on pathology, and you can test for TTF1 and other things. And TTF1 will help you lean toward adenocarcinoma. But being a trial PI and reviewing many pathology records informally, it's shocking how much of it is undifferentiated NSCLC or NOS or consistent with lung cancer, probably non-small cell. Those are the answers that we get for many, many patients. And I think until our attitudes and our approach changes, that we do need more tissue and that we do need pathologists to not just give us a cursory look, but something more detailed to tell us if this is non-squamous or if it's squamous and other details, I think is very important. And I think things like EGFR mutation will lead to that. Right now, many pathologists don't know how to look for or read out EGFR mutation testing. They do it and they say, oh, there's a mutation there. Well, we need to know if the mutation is a deletion or if it's on exon 19, 20, or 21 as opposed to 18. And so I think that type of detail is going to involve the pathologist more, and they will then do more with the tissue. And if they don't have enough tissue, then it's our job to get more tissue.
What do you do when you get that kind of nondescript diagnosis? So sometimes maybe it's coming from an outside place, or you're going to go ahead and get the tissue and delay, or what do you do?
So I default it to what was approved based on the clinical studies. And if you go to the inclusion-exclusion criteria, for instance, of ECOG 4599, those patients would have been eligible to receive bevacizumab. And again, if it was NOS or otherwise not specified. And there were about 15 to 20% of those patients on that study. Again, we don't know if they were squamous or not, but they were allowed in the treatment arm with bevacizumab. And so that, to me, is a little bit reassuring that I can treat those patients. Not that I like what I'm seeing as far as a reading on the pathology. I think from that standpoint, that's really what I use as a final criteria to say, okay, if I had a clinical study, what would they be eligible for? But our preference, obviously, is to have more detail.
What about the selection of chemotherapy, whether you're using bevacizumab or not, in the first-line metastatic setting? How do you go about dealing with that decision?
Yeah, there's a prevailing thought out there about adenocarcinoma and some of the subset we've seen from Scagliotti's trial using cis-pemetrexed versus cis-gemcitabine. Again, my bias is that if you cut adenocarcinoma subsets out of all the major trials, you'd probably see better results across the board. Now, maybe not to the magnitude of some, but even from a bevacizumab standpoint, when they cut the adenocarcinoma data in that study, they had a 14-month median survival. So I think prognostically, you just do better with adenocarcinoma. If a patient does not have a tolerance to bevacizumab, whether I think they're older and are going to be more harmed by more side effects and toxicity, I will have no issue giving them a platinum with pemetrexed. But even in that case, it wouldn't be cisplatin if it were their age or comorbidities. I'd probably give them carboplatin pemetrexed if they were an adenocarcinoma. If it were just a non-squam and it wasn't specifically an adenocarcinoma, then I think really any platinum-based doublet is fine.
Any preferences that you have in terms of that situation?
Well, I think pemetrexed and carboplatin is a very easy regimen to take. I have not made the leap of faith a la the Jodi Patel study where I've combined bevacizumab all the time with this regimen. I think it's being tested in phase 3 studies right now and we'll answer those questions eventually. Right now, it's still a bevacizumab-based chemotherapy first, and if they can't tolerate that and they need something gentler, then I will go with the carboplatin pemetrexed regimen.
So when you say bevacizumab chemotherapy, what's that?
I will either use carboplatin paclitaxel or carboplatin docetaxel. Those are my two first preferences. I think carbopem will definitely be there in the future as well, just I don't use it as much with bevacizumab.
What about the use of cetuximab? I guess it's been over a year now, year and a half, since the first data came out from the FLEX study. Anything new there, and how are you approaching this in your practice?
Well, this drug, unfortunately, did not make approval in Europe. It's still under review in the U.S. here, and I'm hopeful that it will get approved because I think having more options for patients is very important. I will use cetuximab if I can convince insurance companies to allow me to write for it in patients who have squamous. I think squamous is ironically becoming a lot like small cell right now, where we're getting very limited in the drugs that we have available and actually the drugs that really work well. As you know, it doesn't matter if it's a taxane or if it's erlotinib. Pound for pound, squamous cell cancer patients just don't do as well with therapy as opposed to their adenocarcinoma counterpart. I think a platinum taxane regimen with cetuximab is a nice option for patients with squamous cell cancer and would like to use that more often in them.
How do patients tolerate the cetuximab?
You know, they tolerate it just fine. We ran a study, I chaired a study through SWOG, the 0536, which was the combination, it was a quadruplet regimen. It was carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, and cetuximab. And after 6 cycles of the quadruplet, you went on doublet maintenance. So patients were getting cetuximab and bevacizumab. And I would say most of the side effects that affected patients the most were the skin peeling or the nail changes that you get in the hands, especially with cetuximab. We try to manage those supportively as much as possible, and that was probably the main problem. But we had folks who were on past 30 cycles with the doublet, so it's clearly tolerable in some folks. And these are not folks that necessarily developed a rash during the first cycle. I know there's been data out there, that subset data that's looked at that. I think that would be an intriguing way to assess whether someone would be a good candidate for cetuximab is give them three doses and see if they develop a rash. And if they do, continue. If they don't, then maybe switch off.
Assuming you can get paid for, any situations where you might utilize the combination of bevacizumab and cetuximab off study right now?
I have not done that just quite yet because I've been using more of my cetuximab in squamous cell patients that I've been trying to direct. Again, mind you, this is not an FDA-approved regimen at this point. With bevacizumab, I've used more erlotinib combination with it because that's the data that we had done previously, and it is data that Atlas has utilized as well.
And what clinical trial situations right now is this doublet being looked at?
Well, we have a national study that I chair called the SELECT study. This is a second-line study of either pemetrexed or docetaxel with or without cetuximab. It was based on a phase 2 study that I published in Cancer this past year that was docetaxel plus cetuximab and showed a very nice response rate. The primary endpoint was response. So we have translated this into a phase 3 that has now enrolled over 700 patients. We hope to finish enrollment next year and see if the addition of cetuximab helps either pemetrexed or docetaxel in the second-line setting.
What about the combination of bevacizumab and cetuximab in trials?
That has moved forward. So the SWOG-0536 study that I chaired has now moved into a phase 3 study called SWOG-0819. This is a SWOG versus ECOG study. So it's the four-drug regimen, carboplatin, paclitaxel, cetuximab, and bevacizumab, a la the SWOG, versus the ECOG standard regimen of carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab. There will be additional subsets, planned subsets, looking at FISH-positive patients versus not, to see if there's any additional benefit with cetuximab in these FISH-positive patients. But again, the primary endpoint is to assess the efficacy.
What about markers of response? There were a couple papers at ASCO and cetuximab. What about that as well as bevacizumab? I see now they're starting to look at SNPs also.
Yeah, they've got to look at something else because everything they've looked at now doesn't really tell us very much, at least in lung cancer. Everybody was hoping to see something with KRAS mutation as we saw it in colon cancer, but again, we have to be careful extrapolating things. I think it's nice to observe those things, but it doesn't necessarily mean it translates. If you remember in the colon cancer arena, the combinations of antibodies with EGFR and VEGF did not yield any improvement, whereas in our phase 2 study, we did see improvement. And so it's a different disease. SNPs are important. FISH is something that SWOG is looking at. Again, I think the premise here is that we still need to gather tissue and really try and figure out from a broad-based perspective what markers may be relevant. And right now, there are no relevant markers for cetuximab or bevacizumab in non-small cell.